effort to speak up. But my hands were folded so carefully, and my shoes were laced up nice with one knot each. And if my clothes were too tight, I didn't fidget and let it show. Behind me, across the aisle of the small courtroom, sitting for the other side, the side seeking justice for her dead husband, was my mother. Pearl wasn't in the room, of course, since she was only 7 then. I've wondered ever since, wondered at night in B-Wing, and wondered now, in the forced solitude and under the bright lights in D-Wing, what my half-little sister had been told about me, what she understood. It was her father who was taken from her, a man she happily called Daddy, while I'd spat at the ground when my mother said I should start calling him Dad. I weighed less back then. I hadn't yet had my growth spurt. My shoulders hadn't filled out. Still, there was something menacing they saw in me, even at that size. If I stood before the judge now, this big, my jaw set by my habit of tightening it, he would have handed me a guilty conviction in 10 seconds instead of taking a recess and coming back with it in 1 hour and 10 minutes. People can't move on until the finger is pointed and the gavels come down. This is called closure, and it's also called justice, and they are not always the same thing. I thought for sure I was in solitary for days on end, maybe even a week. My leg hairs grew, my stomach shrank. But when the door at last opened, it hadn't been a full 72 hours. I'd made it to Tuesday. The lock turned, and the hole in the door, down low to traffic the food trays, flopped open, and I could see 2 gray-clad legs. A CO. I didn't know which guard was assigned to D-Wing that week. It could have been Long, or Marbleson, sporting the black eye I'd gifted one of them. It could have been Minko. None of us wanted to be trapped alone with Minko. I retreated against the wall as the locks, more installed on this door than in other wings, snapped open. If those 2 gray legs did belong to Minko, I had to be ready. My mind spun over how I might be able to injure him, hoping permanently. If it would be better to use my knuckles or get some leverage and kick with my foot. One of us, Polly, in A-Wing, once fought off a would-be rapist with a hockey stick to the solar plexus. When she reenacted the scene for us, making do with an invisible weapon, she mimicked the sound of his pain and defeat and shame, a deep soul-crushing whimper. We loved to picture her assaulter going down, fish-eyed and flopping on the sidewalk, so we asked her to act out this story again and again. I would be like Polly if I had to be, though I had no sports equipment with which to take him down. But no, it wasn't Minko. The door cranked open, and the CO who entered was Santa Suso. He was practically as young as we were, and cheery, no matter the day. Of course, he was also new. I couldn't have been more lucky. "Hey there," he said. He glanced at a clipboard. "Amber, right?" His eyes skittered around the pitiful space, avoiding me and mine. He seemed ashamed at having to witness me in here. This was his first summer, and we'd caught him acting like he cared. It gave some of us the heebie-jeebies. Others found it endearing. Mississippi was in love with him, and so was Leon. But Peaches warned he might snap at any moment, as it was always the nice ones who had the sickest of the sick stuff buried behind their big blue eyes, and we should watch our backs with him. "Yeah," I said weakly, acknowledging my name. It was weird that he called us by our first names. Most COs used last names for us, as if we were enlisted in the military, and a few just called us inmate, as they were used to working at adult maximum security facilities, where the prisoners didn't even deserve names. "Time to go back to B-Wing, Amber," he said, actually smiling at me. He even had 2 identical dimples, one on each side of his face. He looked like a boy at my old school, like a civilian offering to take a walk with another civilian. When I didn't come forward, when I didn't immediately offer up my wrists so he could cuff them for the walk home, he softened further How are you doing? What's going on? These questions confused and disturbed me. Maybe it would have been better to be confronted with Minko. At least I knew what he wanted. I would have known I was right to be on guard. I shrugged. He flashed his dimples. Except, now that we were talking, now that the door was open and air was coming in, I remembered I had so many questions. First, I needed to know the day. It was Tuesday, he said, which felt impossible in every way, but I went with it. Questions dropped from my mouth one after the other faster than the one before. What happened? I wanted to know. Were you there? Did you see? Did they catch everyone? What was it? What went wrong? Could it happen again? He interrupted to explain that this was his first shift since Friday, so he wasn't clear on what happened Saturday night, if that's what I was asking. But he must know something. Is she dead? I said. Damore. The blonde? He said, not unkindly. Drug trafficking, right? I didn't take the bait. We don't talk about one another's crimes to anyone in authority. We know what we know, and we don't ask after what we don't know. I wouldn't agree or deny that I was aware of what she'd done to get her 18 months, and I wouldn't put in an opinion on if she was guilty or if she was innocent. It's best to say, we are all innocent. I saw her at the fence, I said. I saw her go up in lights. That was the only way I could think to describe it, like she was a fireworks show for the 4th of July. A holiday we didn't get to celebrate in here. She's okay, he said. In the infirmary. Second-degree burns, I think I heard. But she's not bad off enough to be transferred. I guess I didn't react. She's alive, he continued, assuring me. That fence is electric, you know, but she's okay. Really. Maybe he thought I cared more about her well-being than I did. That I'd been crying over her in here. For Damore, I hadn't shed one tear. He secured my wrists, the usual protocol when being transported from one cell to another. We got used to it. And we started out the door. I'll tell Damore you were asking about her, he said casually, as he shuffled me forward. She's not coming back to B-Wing. What? Why not? She's moving to A-Wing. You're getting a new roomie today. Who's getting transferred? Lola? Kennedy? Oh, no, yeah, that's a whole other story. You're getting someone brand new. I was made to walk ahead of him, and I considered this piece of information. The prick of memory nipped me. We were passing the stairwell between B-Wing and the canteen. The sensation of having known what he was telling me, known it was coming because I'd lived it before, grabbed me. She was coming. She was the next thing to come after the locks. Once she was here, everything would go wrong. Of that, I felt certain. I jolted in Santa Suso's grasp. We'd reached the entry gate to B-Wing. We were almost home. Cuffs too tight? He asked. I shook my head. I knew I shouldn't ask, shouldn't let him in on anything more than I had already because he wasn't one of us, no matter how young he was and how nice he seemed with his dimples. I asked anyway. Does her name... It was coming to me. There it was. Start with an O. You been watching the news? I thought they monitored what played on the rec TVs. But yeah, you know who I mean then. It's in all the papers, too. Keep an eye on yourself, all right? What'd she do? Even as I said it, I felt I should know the answer. Something in his face said so, too. Then his face shifted and darkened, and I lost the two dimples, and everything else was a blur. I felt his hands turning the handcuffs lock to let mine go, and I sensed him drifting off. Leaving me before the open door to my cell as if I'd wandered here all alone without needing permission from anybody. It was an odd moment, and that was only the beginning. The sign that said Wyatt had been removed from the cinderblock wall outside my cell, and a new sign, one that said Spearling, was attached in its place. Damour's things had been cleared out of our shared cell, and the top bunk was stripped, indicating a new arrival would show up soon. This new arrival would be our 42nd. She was surrounded. She was surrounded by guards. She came in under siege, as if she might lunge and go for the closest throat. But from our vantage point, from our place of wisdom and experience and occasional regret, she looked nothing like the rumors made her out to be. So much so that I began to wonder if they'd been mistaken, if they'd caught the wrong girl. She was known by the state as inmate number 47709-01, and known by the public as Oriana Spearling. But if we'd followed the sensationalized news stories, we'd have heard the press call her the Bloody Ballerina, and we would have come up with a few pictures of our own thanks to that. I watched, many of us were watching, from my cell window as the short blue bus from the county jail approached the curb. The COs converged before the bus door even opened. We always made an effort to check out the new arrivals, but something about today drew more of us than ever before. We looked down from above, from our cells, as those of us on the south side of the facility always did when the bus was due to arrive. Sometimes we were looking for family, long-lost cousins, and half-sisters from estranged, despised fathers we wished were dead. The fathers, not the sisters. Or we'd see a friend we didn't want joining us here. So witnessing her step off the bus with her ankles in chains broke another jagged bit off what remained of our hearts. Sometimes, on good days, when the sun was shining for us, we would spot an enemy from outside emerging from that bus. This was a gift from the universe, a reason to fold our hands in the night and mutter our thank yous because she'd been handed over like a sweet treat on a plate. No matter who it was, the fact is it could always be someone. That day, the blue bus held just one girl.
"Do you think she'll get her own room and no one will ever see her like with Anne-Marie?"
Many of us had heard of little Anne-Marie, and some of us had spotted her from a distance. No one relished the idea of her getting released into the general population.
"Nah, I heard she's in B-Wing with Amber."
They spoke about me as if I weren't right there.
"Think she'll go psycho killer and slit Amber's throat in the night." "Oh, sure, if she can find something sharp."
"If not, she could just strangle her."
"Drew, you could do that with your bare hands."
"Or a bedsheet."
They then discussed all the other everyday weapons we had available for those with a creative streak and a worthy target. I kept any reactions to myself. It was so rare to hear my name aloud, spoken by another girl here, that I felt my cheeks heating up more than they were already, which was to a slow boil, thanks to the upstate August humidity. I wanted to cover my whole face with my hands. The other girls often didn't speak to me directly, unless they had to when I wheeled around the library cart. It was more like they spoke near me, and I listened in. I thought of us together as one, and included myself in their conversations, like a silent partner hovering behind their chairs. But all that changed as the other girls gathered at my window, peering down. It was hearing my name aloud, being acknowledged in a way I often wasn't. That was when it settled over me, the feeling of being included, of belonging, like we were family now, more than ever before. Someone poked me hard in the ribs, indicating I should move over, and my side pulsed from the pain, but I didn't mind. I wasn't used to being touched. This new girl, this Oriana Spearling, she'd turned me into a celebrity simply because she was one. Any girl made to share a cell with her would have been treated the same.
"Watch your back," a voice said in my ear, and the guffaw told me it was Jody.
"I'm not scared," I said, and a bunch of them laughed, thumping me on the back
and massaging my shoulders like they were going to push me to the center of the ring for a boxing bout. We returned our attention to the new inmate down below. Three COs were waiting to receive her from the county guys. She paused on the lip of the sidewalk. She actually stopped moving, as if she had all day to dawdle and wanted to check out the view first. And we watched her. We watched her gaze at our gray stone walls, which we knew rose like a fortress. We watched her take a breath in the thin air and gaze upward at our windows, and we wondered if she could see our peering eyes. She was tall, and maybe too thin from what we could tell, with her wearing the shapeless jumpsuit from jail. On the back it claimed her county, Saratoga. We whispered that rich girls lived there in big fat houses with their fancy cars. There weren't many of us, inside, who came from money, and we immediately disliked anyone who did. But none of us had ever been to Saratoga, so we didn't know for sure. The new girl had medium brown skin and thick, straight black hair too long to keep in here. She'd learn that soon enough. None of us could tell if she was Latina or mixed. Some of us thought that mattered, but others of us said it didn't matter what you looked like in here. You were here, after all. The ugliest of us, and those who didn't waste their canteen accounts on items that could be substituted for eyeliner or mascara, said this all the time. Mirabel started taking bets. The odds were stacked against anyone who thought the new girl wouldn't put up a fight. Most everyone assumed she was taking a moment before an exciting, explosive show of violence. They bet their Reese's on it. Other bets went down saying at least she'd cry. A few of us thought she'd try to make a run for it. But that was only wishful thinking, because it was kind of funny when a girl thought she'd get anywhere with her ankles in chains. I didn't place a bet. I knew I'd be alone with her soon enough. It felt like playing a trick on your own dog. We waited and watched, and nothing. She didn't try to raise a buckled fist. She didn't sob. She didn't make even one attempt at a shackled running leap. The longer we watched, the more we wanted to take back our bets and save our Reese's cups. Mirabel heaved a loud sigh and dropped her running tally. Sherry scarfed one of the Reese's she'd bet on the win, and the cramped space filled with the scent of peanut butter. Down below, the new girl was taking her first steps onto the cracked sidewalk. There was something about the way she held her body, with a magnetic kind of grace that, if we ignored the telltale armed guards and the desolate barbed wire fencing in the background, if we ignored the things we always tried to ignore, it made us forget where we were for a moment. She didn't look foam-mouthed or haunted and on edge, her head full of razors. She didn't look like a killer at all to us. And this the opinion of killers. She looked like a girl on a sunny sidewalk on a summer's day. Calm and at peace. Free. We blinked. Was this the notorious criminal we'd overheard the COs talking about? The girl whose face some of us had seen flash on the guard's TV? Maybe she'd crumble before she got to us, and by the time she reached B-Wing, she'd be a shell of her former self. If not, reality would hit her fast once she was inside. We always said this when the rare princess arrived, and then a group of us would gang up on the girl out by the woodshop and make sure. Her dose of the real world, the floor meeting her face, hard. But no one was threatening to hurt the new girl, not even Jody.
Huh, one of us said. So that's the big-time murderer?
Boring, said another with the yawp of a yawn.
I could take her, mumbled one more.
They filtered away, losing interest, suggesting card games, slinging gossip, wondering what would be for dinner, until I was alone in my cell. I was the only one still watching, but nothing more happened. She walked out of view, and I guess she was escorted inside, as we all had been. Next I knew came processing. She'd join us in B-Wing within hours. She'd be wearing newbie orange. She'd sleep in the same kind of bed we slept in, count the mold flecks on the same stretch of ceiling that we'd been counting. Just because the papers and the news shows had all those stories about her and showed slideshows of her pictures, it didn't make her special. We were, all of us, the exact opposite of special. We were bad. Broken. It was up to the state to rehabilitate us into something worthy, if it even could. Maybe, long ago, we used to be good. Maybe all little girls are good in the beginning. There might even be pictures of us from those easy days, when we wore braids and colorful barrettes, and played in sandboxes, and on swing sets, if we knew days so easy, or wore such barrettes. There was a photo of me, in a red checked shirt, and two braids at the neighborhood park. I had a raised shovel, and had lost a tooth, but I smiled anyway. My mother used to have that photo in a frame. But something happened to us between then and now. Something threw sand in our eyes, ground it in, and we couldn't get it out. We still can't. Oriana Spearling was shipped up here like anyone else. She was guilty. The juvenile justice system said so. So, that had to mean she belonged. I could wait. I could wait for her to show up in my cell, bundled blanket in her arms like a refugee, and make our introductions, try to be welcoming the way I was with Damore. But it was Tuesday afternoon, and on Tuesday and Thursday afternoons, I wheeled the book cart through the wings. I had to go. Most girls weren't too interested in spending voluntary time flapping the pages of some stale old book, but there was always someone needing the escape, like a gulp of fresh water in the desert. Besides, not every book in our library was old. Some were fresh-faced and still had the new paper smell, and reading a new book before anyone else got to was like getting the first hot lunch and not the murky, lukewarm depths of the middle of the line, or worse, canned bean cold like the last few trays. Some were books we shouldn't have even had, judging by the well-thumbed sections paged down for sharing. But thinking of what some girls did under cover of a strategically draped blanket while reading a certain section of The Clan of the Cave Bear made me squeamish. The point is, every book we had could save us in a different way. Only, we had to open it. We had to drop our eyes to the page and drink in the words that were there. I'd wheel my cart onto a wing, top tier first, then bottom. I'd slow in cell doorways. This was during free time, when we were allowed to drift around and have open doors, even allowed to have guests, no more than two at a time, in our small cells. And all I'd do was make my presence known, my cart seen. Someone on each wing always wanted something. I'd hand a book over, and it would be grabbed from my hand with something like hunger. I'd seen this happen with Anne of Green Gables, and with every volume of Vampire Academy, with ragged, well-read copies of The Catcher in the Rye, and with Speak. With the Bible, and the Bhagavad Gita, and a manual for repairing the engine of a 1982 Mustang. I'd seen an obscure, dust-encrusted edition of Good Morning Midnight slipped inside a green jumpsuit, as if to keep it as close as possible, and come to think of it, I haven't seen that book since. It was important, what I did, necessary, and even for the arrival of my new cellmate, I couldn't miss it. That was why, when I reported for duty and discovered my book cart missing, I wasn't sure what to do. The library, technically a patch of hallway, but I insisted on calling it the library as if it were its own room, had been ransacked. Whole gaps of books were missing from the shelves I'd organized, and the cards on which I kept the borrowers' names were tossed aside, the A's with the E's, the C's on the floor. But it was the cart that unhinged me. The cart was made of pale, glossy wood and built with shelves, two tiers like in our cell blocks, and with four rubber wheels, even though one of the wheels didn't take to ground so well, and spun, making it difficult to steer. Not finding the cart made me want to howl, made me want to scream. No one had messed with my cart before or taken so many books with so much recklessness. We'd never had such an enthusiastic reader. Or worse, what if no one was even reading? There were a number of places the books could have made off to. A vat of rancid sauce in the kitchen. That bathroom outside D-Wing no one could use because the toilets were eternally blocked up with chunks of concrete and gray silt. That was where my mind went, to destruction. I marched over to the closest CO's office. I registered a small disappointment at seeing Blit at the helm, all coffee breath and sneer. She could not be made to joke with us, like Marbleson could, like sometimes Long could, if hanging out with Marbleson. She didn't bend to our wills after a peep down an open shirt, like Minko might. But that was a whole other dangerous game I wouldn't play. I was just in the library, I said, knocking on the door jamb and jolting Blit to attention. She'd been watching a rerun of the Oriana Spearling trial on TV. She smirked and shut off the picture.
You mean the hallway, inmate?
She never called us by our given names, last or first. We knew what she meant by it, hoping we'd feel like a scuffed ant under the sole of a shoe, but I suspected she was kind of slow in the head and just couldn't remember our names. Refusing to call the library a library was a sticking point with me. The official books that belonged to the detention center, the regulation ones we used for our classes and had to read by order of the Department of Education, were not shelved in what I knew as my library. They were on the other side of the facility where we had school. We weren't allowed to take those books back to our cells. Those books were for learning only. They couldn't be used to carry messages or love notes, couldn't snuggle up in bed or inspire a happy dream or a decent orgasm. Some girls bragged, most were suspected of faking. The books in my hallway library were our own collection, and all from donations, often from church groups or private schools ditching their dog-eared copies for pristine new works. These books were ours and only ours. Owning something while under detention gave the time less weight, and Blit knew that. It was why she kept calling it the hallway. Where is my cart? I demanded. I didn't talk often, to inmates, especially to COs, but when I did, I had a whole lot of saved up air in my lungs and I could be loud. My cart, I spat out, fist on glass that wasn't supposed to ever shatter, but maybe I could make it shatter, maybe my fist could. What happened to my cart?
Inmate, settle down, Blit said. You want me to write you up for this? It's just a cart. It's a pile of books. Calm yourself.
It was the condescending act she used like a whip on a bare back. She had information and I needed it. Steam shot from my ears, but I lowered my fist from the glass and my eyes from Blitz's helmet head, and I took myself to a calm place, a faraway place. Sometimes I tried to picture it, and it looked a lot like Florida.
Want to lose your visiting privileges? No visitor next week or the week after? No visitor all month?
This was the perfect thing to say to incite me, but for a whole host of other reasons, and she knew it.
That's right, you don't get visitors, do you? You've never had a single one.
My eyes burned with a filmy liquid that could not be called tears. Finally, I had my breathing under control. I loosened the set bomb that was my fist. She waited. She waited a long time. Then, she said, with a wink of her very tiny, very pig-like eyes from behind her glasses, I saw Ward wheeling your cart around over to C-Wing.
Cannibal Kennedy?
I roared, imagining all the stray hair I'd find in the pages after, wondering if she'd chewed on paper, too, if there'd be bite marks on the covers and gnawed pulp on the insides, wet slobber marks from her squicky tongue. I wondered, growing panicked, if there'd be smears. Blit shrugged. She was useless now. She didn't know anything else.
I figured she'd arranged something with you, she said, since you were late today.
I'd just gotten out of solitary. I wasn't more than 20 minutes late for my usual shift. A half hour, tops. Then I remembered, because I'd overheard some girls talking. Isn't Kennedy... I searched for a good word to prove I hadn't seen the carnage at the hands of Lola the other night myself. Recovering? And what would you know about that inmate? Nothing. She got out of the infirmary this morning. Can't say the same for your French fry of a cellmate, though. She made a sizzling sound between her teeth. Didn't you hear? I'm getting someone else today. I waved at her dark TV. The new girl. Remember? Maybe it was something I said, but the expression on her face was a funny one. A shifting and a sinking and a darkening. A blur. I couldn't look at her anymore. It made me feel funny, too, something about the word remember. I took off for Sea Wing, hoping to catch Kennedy. I started to run, and Blit didn't shout at me to stop running, as she lived to do. She didn't threaten me with privileges taken if I didn't slow down. She didn't shout after me at all. I raced through the halls without passing another CO. It wasn't long before I found Kennedy, exiting Sea Wing and heading for A. She was marked with bruises, her face the color of raw bacon, a meat item I hadn't tasted since I was 13. But she was upright and walking, and she was well enough to push the cart with a haphazard pile of books on it. She steered it clumsily into walls and then righted it, switching directions, hitting the wall opposite. A book of Rimbaud's collected poems dropped with his pretty boy face to the floor tile, and she didn't even go back to pick him up. It was a miracle she wasn't dead or in a coma after the number Lola did on her. Kennedy! Stop the cart! She turned with what looked like a good amount of effort. She seemed to be having difficulty swiveling her swollen head on her swollen neck. Her ear was an eggplant, by color and almost by size. Kennedy always inspired sympathy. Someone that pathetic had to, if we still bothered to care about worldly things like human suffering. But I didn't care that Kennedy was a walking punching bag, her insides a sloppy soup from Lola's stomping feet. I didn't care that Lola had done this to her, and I didn't care that Lola could turn and do this to any one of us next. All I wanted was my books back. I wouldn't have minded if Kennedy dropped like a sack of potatoes, as she had the other night, just so she could get her grabby hands off my cart. She didn't drop. Her fingers held fast to my cart, though the whole rest of her wobbled.
It's mine now, Amber, she eked out. You got transferred. Yesterday.
I stared at her as she spoke, the spittle at the corners of her mouth, the cut in her bottom lip that bloomed the red of a rose. She let go of the cart for a moment to wipe snot from her nose.
You're in the kitchen now. The book cart isn't yours anymore.
I didn't understand. Couldn't. Wouldn't. I wasn't even gone 3 days, and I lost my life skills job and got moved, and Santa Suso didn't tell me? There wasn't much talking that could fix this. The cart came at her like a semi skidding into the opposite lane in the icy night. The cart slammed her in the shins, and then the cart reversed and made a run for it like a semi doubling back over a pair of legs. It wasn't me doing it. It was the cart. Then I was wrapped in a pair of thick arms and I was flailing. Not solitary again, not the whole. Not more time on my sentence, because that was worse. We all knew that was the worst that could be thrown at us. More weeks, more months, more years. But it wasn't a CO who had me. The arms holding me in place were in green. Jody. The towering brick house that was Jody. She was even bigger than me. She set me down and turned me to face her, hands still pressing on my shoulders to keep me glued to the floor. She's had enough. Our eyes together found the sniveling lump on the floor. The lump sat up and leaned against the cinder block wall, heaving. Then the lump grabbed a hunk of hair and started chomping. Between us and unclaimed was the book cart. Splayed on its side, contents exploded, spines split and spilling, pages mashed up. I reached out an arm for it. though it was too far away to grab even one book, but Jody took the arm in her large hand and lowered it to my side. Behind her came Peaches, all swagger. "Hey, bitches," she said, nodding to the lump on the floor and to me, still cradled in Jody's arms like a mother and child who had love for each other. I didn't mind so much. Peaches righted the cart and generously, which was unlike her since she never made any effort for anything that didn't get her something in return, began to stack the books on the tiered shelves. Kennedy whimpered. Jody smoothed back my hair, straightened out my greens.
"Why'd you go and do that, Amber? You don't have a violent bone in your body," Jody said.
We all knew she knew violence, had grown up with it in her house, had hidden from it in closets during the night, had then gotten up in its face and run away from it, had modeled after it on the streets, had made a name for herself with it, had let it carry her all the way up here. She'd told all of us. Violence was what she knew, so you'd think she would have recognized it in me. Peaches nodded, eyeing me up.
"The only innocent one here," she recited,
like she'd heard it somewhere before. That wasn't a compliment. She was calling me weak, saying I was a coward. I took a step toward the books, but Jody kept me back. What were they saying? That I wasn't really one of them? That I didn't belong here with them? That it wasn't us against the state? Us against the world? Peaches finished stacking the books and was now testing out the wheels, kicking at the bad one, trying to get it to spin all the way around.
"This has nothing to do with you, Amber. There's so much going on around here you don't even know."
That couldn't be. She didn't have her ear to the ground like I did. She wasn't always watching, absorbing, keeping track. Didn't they know I was the one who kept track? "Can I have my cart back now?" I asked. They didn't answer. "Can I have my cart?"
"Peaches is gonna do the books now," Jody said. "It makes sense. She's got things to run around. She's got things."
"Yeah," Peaches piped in. "I got things."
Jody rammed the cart into the wall beside Peaches, and Peaches got it in her grip before it bounced back. We heard a miserable voice from the floor.
"But it's my job now," Kennedy said. "They said..."
We ignored her, as always. At least we were united in that. We heard the approaching thump of a CO, and we scattered. Peaches skated away on my book cart, Jody sped off, and for a giant she vanished fast. Even Kennedy crawled a little ways, and then got to her feet and started lurching. I headed another way, and not for the library, or Blit in her booth, or for B-Wing, not for anywhere, really, because if I went back to my cell, there'd be a stranger taking over my space. I didn't know where I was headed. All I knew was I had to force myself to think of Florida, and I had to be calm. Kennedy, and then Jody and Peaches, had taken all I had. What was this place to me if now I had nothing? I was outside the infirmary when I heard her.
"Amber? Amber," she called. "Where were you? Where'd you go? You should be here. Come here."
Demure was inside, near the door. A few inmates were gathered at the foot of her bed. She was wrapped in white gauze all around her arms and legs, even covering patches of her face, mummified but still able to speak out of her throat, if a little raspily. Her once blonde hair, where it could be seen through the bandages, was the color of coal. She beckoned me over and continued her spiel. I'd come in the middle of something.
"And everything we do, we'll do again," Demore announced.
She closed her eyes. She gestured at the air with her stiff, bandaged fingers.
"And everything we see, we've seen now 3 times. And the doors were opened, but they've been opened 3 times. We run, and we run again, and we run, and they catch you, and you go away 3 times, Amber."
She opened her eyes, nodded at me, kept on. Then the new girl dances around the room 3 times, and 3 times Natty shouldn't trip her, tell her, and the plants are growing in the windows, and you say, no, Damore, no. And next summer it's the same thing, except it's 4, and the summer after it's 5. She kept going. She reached 7, she reached 8, she reached 9. She was speaking like some kind of hokey visionary, and we were her flock who climbed the mountain to drink it in and maybe get our fortunes told next. It was a load of nonsense. Or was it? A feeling tickled the bottoms of my feet, like something reaching up from deep down in me, wanting me to be reminded, to remember. 3 times Damore had said at the beginning. I felt like I'd heard her say this already. 3 times. I didn't want anyone to know that. What's wrong with her? I whispered.
She got zapped in the head, Little T whispered back. Lightning.
No, it was the fence. You think that's what did it?
Little T gave a shrug. I got my meds. Got to go.
She crushed the tiny paper cup a nurse must have given her, though I didn't see any nurses, dropped it in the trash, and backed away. The rest of the girls drifted off, too, leaving me alone with Damore, the two of us, the way I was used to, in the night, in our small shared space, where we huddled behind a barred door until our jailers said it could open.
You understand, don't you, Amber? She said.
Yeah. I said, I think so. I wasn't even lying. I'd witnessed some things she hadn't even mentioned. I wanted to tell her about the intruder, but before I could, Damore had her arm up, pointing with a rigid stabbing motion at the wall. She shook and shook her head, her bandages coming loose and revealing fried patches of skin. She covered her blinking eyes. I turned slowly to see what had unsettled her so, expecting to find the white walls of the infirmary, this being the whitest room in the whole facility, expecting to roll my eyes at her crazy, dismiss the ramblings of her sautéed brain. It would have been so much easier that way. Instead, I saw what she saw. Colors. Whorls and splashes and squiggles and scribbles and vacant, senseless streaks. The graffiti again. The unforgettable Bridget Love was here again, so-and-so plus so-and-so, and another R.I.P. But more than that, even worse, the cinder blocks of our walls were broken through, chipped out like kicked-in teeth, and the ceiling was crumbling down over our heads, shedding silt and concrete dust that was gray and sharper than sand. The floor was black with mold and spongy with moss, so my feet sank. Through the gaping holes in the walls, I could see out. I could see as far as the parking lot, which had no vehicles in it and was taken over by weeds. Past that, I could see that what surrounded us was edging in even closer than before. The forest was coming for our fences. The trees were growing through our gates. The vines hadn't stopped climbing. We were being swallowed. We were being choked in leaves and moss and living, searing green. This was all that would be left of us in not so many years. Time didn't matter much in eternity. The days of this sentence couldn't be marked off on a wall and counted. Through a gouge in the ceiling, I could see up and up to a picturesque piece of heaven, which was really only a chunk of blue sky. It was a perfectly nice August day wherever we were. It always would be. I rushed out of the infirmary. And with that, with the simple act of leaving the room and getting away from Damore, the walls in the corridor returned to their clean, solid color, their familiar green, which matched my jumpsuit, also green, the one I somehow knew would be the jumpsuit I'd forevermore be wearing. As I walked the hallway toward B-Wing, I was only following steps I'd taken before. We all were. We always would be. We kept forgetting, and we also couldn't let go. We were eye to eye. We were eye to eye at the door to my cell. Our cell now. Her eyes were brown and deep. Mine were brown too, but I hadn't looked in a workable mirror in some time, so maybe they'd changed. We met there in the doorway, staring at each other. It was only a moment, but there was a flicker. Some kind of connection, like the passing memory of having known each other before. Then it was snuffed out, like when the lights go down at night before we're ready, and all we can do is make the hatch mark in the cinder block to show one more day served toward release, toward our new life. It was hoped we might have two lives, the way cats are said to have nine. This life we ruined, and another for after. She dropped her gaze first, then she stepped aside for me so I could enter. She'd claimed Damore's top bunk, and Damore's shelves. Her canvas slip-ons were where Damore's had been, in the tub outside the door. And her feet were socked, and narrow, and quite long. She'd already claimed Damore's only hook. Now it was her hook. Now we would breathe the same air. She would sleep to the sound of my heart beating, and I'd sleep to the sound of hers. Neither of us had spoken. I should have gone first, said, welcome, or something shorter and more cryptic, like, hey. Here was the moment to drop some wisdom from my 3 years, 1 month, and 15 days of being incarcerated at Aurora Hills. But I kept it back. I'd tried to be helpful the last time, with Damore, and look where that got me. Besides, I had other things on my mind. The loss of my book cart. The transfer to the kitchen, which was noted and official now, listed under my name outside the cell. All the rest, the sense of what was coming, seemed so far away. It was a forgetting like a heavy door being closed. It would take a lot of effort to push it open. I sat on my bottom bunk, curled my knees in. A job in the kitchen would involve spills and smells that were sour, rancid, sickening. There would be burns from oven racks and hot plates, wrinkled palms from searing dishwater. I'd be pruned after every shift. I'd stink. What there wouldn't be were the books. The soothing sound as they cascaded open. A thumb flicked to give them a good fast skim. There wouldn't be a way to travel from wing to wing, listening. No wheels on the cart spinning, carrying the stories, the words. I felt gutted. Alone. Alone, like in the interrogation room at the police station, when they didn't bring me a glass of water, and they didn't let me leave the table, and they said they had my diary, and they said they saw what I wrote in it, and I asked for my mom, and I asked who gave them my diary, and I said I was thirsty, and I asked again for my mom, and they didn't bring me a glass of water, and my mom didn't come. The new girl hovered near me. Did I do something? She asked. Are you upset you have to room with me? I grunted. I'd been in long enough to know how to act around a cold-blooded killer. We could never be caught seeming nervous. We should always reveal only a small tip-of-the-iceberg version of ourselves and submerge the rest. The very last thing we should show is fear, and if we did, we were toast. She didn't look so much like a cold-blooded killer, but still, this was better. Safe. Did they tell you who I am? Her voice was the one shaking. Oriana, I said, the name bubbling up without any effort to grab it. Call me Ori. I don't mind. Somehow I'd expected that. I gave her a nod. Her knees were jittering in her baggy orange pants. I could see the outlines of them beneath the thin fabric, rocking. She didn't ask if I knew what she had done. I guess I'm your new roommate, she said. It was funny the way she talked, as if the small space we were made to exist in could be called a room. That simple word could make it seem like we were anywhere but in a dank, dark prison. Cellmate, I corrected. She shouldn't sugarcoat it. That's what I meant. I'm Amber. You can call me Amber.
I know.
They told me.
I heard you're innocent.
Who said that?
The others?
Part of me bristled at the idea of being talked about behind my back. But I also liked it, liked being a topic of conversation, visible when I'd thought I wasn't. I kind of liked it a lot. If I could have smiled, I would have. But my face always seemed to contradict what I was thinking. I knew I looked angry when I was sad. I looked angry when I was happy. Angry when I was checking the clock on the wall to see what time it was. I'd been told I came out of the womb looking angry. My brows furrowed my mouth like a knife. It was when I really was angry that I wondered if I finally looked like myself.
What are you here for? She asked. I mean, what do they say you did?
You're not supposed to ask me that.
In the interrogation room at the police station, no one had thought me innocent. My own stepfather would have stood up out of his grave and pointed a crooked finger at me. The fingers of his right hand were crooked in the sockets from a fist punched against unforgiving wood when he was aiming for a dodging head. He would have declared me guilty if he still could.
Sorry, she said.
I made myself busy smoothing the sheets on my bunk. She would not shut up.
If you're innocent, she said to my back, you must be so pissed off then. I mean, you must hate every single person here.
How wrong she was. She was new, so she didn't sense the connection. Didn't know the rhythm of our feet in the corridors, how it felt to be in tune with them, 2 feet among so many. To look like everyone else, to wear what they were wearing, to eat what they were eating, to stand up and be counted when they were counted, to sit down when they were allowed to sit. To fit in somewhere in the world, even if there were chains and gates and fences to keep us from running. And more, to have felt the magic of that night, that one night, when bungled technology failed our captors and winked instead in our direction. When the place was ours, and the COs had vanished, and we didn't know or care where, and the rain came down, and the song that played was made of our wails and our screams, we remembered it like a dream. And she'd missed it. She didn't know. She thought I was thinking of my innocence.
How many years did you get? She asked.
That was one question it was okay to answer. We all shared our time and lamented over every last day. But when I thought then of the time I had left, I didn't bristle. My blood didn't boil. My eyes didn't sting with the effort of not tearing up. I didn't know how to say the words to her or to anyone. But I wasn't enraged anymore about my sentence. In the beginning I was, choking on it in the night when my first cellmate was sleeping. Eva, breaking and entering, out in 7 months. But I guess I'd softened. I'd gotten used to being here. I got used to the rules and having my jumpsuit buttons done all the way up and my shoes off inside the cell and my books off the bed and my eyes on the floor when a CO yelled in my face. The bad things, the very bad, like stripping down for the coffin squat we didn't like to speak of. I guess I got used to them. I settled the way people do. I've heard, or I read somewhere, that humans can find ways to adapt to most anything. Now Ori paused and made herself busy with her jumpsuits, folding them and neatening them, though we were issued only 3 and she was already wearing 1. She was being shy now. Maybe I would show her the ropes. Give her the what to always do and the what to never ever do if you want to keep the nose unbroken on your God-given face. She had only me to show her. Look at how her hands were shaking, folding her oranges. I was all she had. As she worked, she kept her eyes on the wall.
Aren't you going to ask me if I did it? She said.
Maybe she wanted to pronounce herself innocent so we could be the same. That could be what this was.
I kept my mouth closed and did not ask. That was how to live around here, without asking too many questions. Better not to go around dangling your curiosities for everyone to view. That would be rude.
No, she said, wanting me to ask it.
No, that's none of my business.
It was the most private thing we had left, held even closer than our bodies, because our bodies were searched, all holes and crevices and cavities in every horrible way that could be imagined. But no one could shake out the truth from inside us. They couldn't search us for that. Our guilt and our innocence were only our own, and she should know to keep it that way.
You can ask me, she started. No, I said, I can't.
Sorry,
she apologized a lot. I tried to remember how many she'd been said to kill. Only two, or was it three? I wondered what happened after she got her first taste. Would two dead be enough for her? Would three, four? Would any amount ever be enough? Would she always be chasing after more? All questions I could not and would not ask her out loud, least of all the question of whether or not she was guilty. Then again, there were methods of wringing it out. The first way was easiest and didn't even involve an improvised weapon, which was good because all I had in the cell were two books and an extra bar of soap. There was a way of solving the question of her guilt without having to ask. There was always a way. And after enough time inside, we found our methods of digging without causing offense. I didn't even need words. Guilt is in the eyes, for those of us who've been around long enough and know what to look for. And the first thing I saw of her were her two wide brown eyes. Hers didn't skitter or blink at odd moments. There was no shifting, no blank haze. When she looked at me, when I let her meet my gaze, I couldn't find the telltale signs, the way another one of us, Mirabelle, Lola, Polly, Sherry, Little T, Damore, I could go on, might have given away her true colors by a shrewd sideways glance or a distant pupil jitter. This new girl only eyed me back. She wasn't trying to hide anything that I could make out. She wasn't trying to pull one over on me. I could sleep in the bunk below her with my bare neck exposed without any ounce of worry that night. Mostly what I found in her eyes was a singular feeling, and it struck me. Past the sadness, I mean. Beyond that, and down deep in her sockets, what I found was surprise. Part of her still didn't believe she was locked away in here. Only a skilled sociopath, a true mastermind, or a girl sentenced for a crime she did not commit when she thought the world would never do something like that to her, would reflect this back to me. Life. We'd long known it was cruel. But she was new. I guess this was her first reckoning. Hey, so I started, until I heard it coming. In the quiet, it rang out. I heard the familiar glide and shuffle, shuffle and glide, the back wheel on the left spinning loose on its axle, off track and off rhythm from the others. The book cart came to a stop in front of our open doorway. There were a few minutes remaining of free time, and the cart had finally arrived on B-Wing. But I wasn't at the helm. And Ori wouldn't know me to be. For her, from day one at Aurora Hills, the girl who ran the book cart and worked the library would be Peaches. Peaches raised her chin to me. What you want? I shook my head. I would not take a book, and I would not take one of her pills as an apology. Ah, too soon? I stared down the wall, which did not stare back at me. I wouldn't let her rattle me. The cart barely had any books on it, and the ones there were just tossed on, upside down, disorganized. It hurt to look. Gotta check your window, Peaches said, shoving herself into our already cramped space to climb up on what was now Ori's top bunk. Ours was the